This is a production of Cornell University.
Hello, welcome. It's great to see you all here. I'm Joni Mikowski, assistant professor with the Creative Writing Program. It's my honor to introduce our guest this afternoon, Carl Phillips. I'd like to begin by offering thanks to the two anonymous donors, both Cornell alums, who through their contributions have made our reading series possible. This wonderful opportunity to celebrate the vibrant literary tradition alive today. And let me remind you, please, to turn off your cell phones. Okay. It's so exciting to have Carl Phillips here, one of the foremost poets today. Carl Phillips has published 11 books of poems, most recently Speak Low, and his selected poems Quiver of Arrows. His 12th collection is coming out next year. He's a young, vital, and prolific writer. Both Speak Low and his book The Rest of Love were finalists for the National Book Award, and his The Tether was awarded the Kingsley Tufts Award. Phillips has also published a book of essays on craft, The Coin of the Realm, essays that show his intense and thoughtful conversation with a wide tradition of literature, a conversation that infuses his own poetry. J.D. McClatchy, in his introduction to Carl Phillips' work in the Vintage Anthology of Contemporary American Poetry, writes that the language of Carl Phillips' poems so shimmers it can obscure the better to illuminate. Myths are unsheathed and glisten. History is held and pondered. His lines fall forward, alternately hesitant and passionate, like a latter-day metaphysical poet's search for precision through abundance. His poems work intuitively through layers of speculation towards metaphors larger than the truth. And McClatchy isn't alone in comparing Phillips' work to such forebears as the Metaphysicals. Writing of Phillips' work, reviewers make comparisons to Herbert and Donne, and also to Hopkins and Keats. Phillips' poems call to mind what endures. While not religious poems in any traditional sense, Phillips' poems nonetheless engage in the struggle to wrestle sacredness from our daily world. As such, the poems immerse themselves in paradoxes, tensions between ecstatic release and bondage, abandon and restraint, pleasure and pain, soul and body, and the poems, in their form, enact this sense of paradox, full of ellipsis and obliqueness of the half-said, the suggested, the revised. There's an ephemeral quality to their assertions, but this ephemerality is matched by the syntax, which, in its sinuous turns and twists, enacts robust bodily pleasure. Torn down the page and jagged lines cutting across muscular sentences, the poems almost seem fragments, as if new renderings of Archilochus or Sappho. And Phillips' muscular fragmentary utterances carry with them the full weight of human mystery. Conversations with a long tradition of poetry has led Carl Phillips to his resonant contributions. He's trained as a classicist, and his writing is very clearly informed by vast reading. An early poem, Leda After the Swan, from his first book, In the Blood, takes up where Greek myth and Yeats left off. And also, as if answering Yeats' question, and did she put his knowledge with his power on before the indifferent beak could let her drop? In Phillips' poem, Leda says, I recognized something more than swan, I can't say. There was just this barely defined shoulder whose feathers came away in my hands. My students yesterday were taken by how Phillips' poem, so different from Yeats, shows the swan's vulnerability. In Phillips' poems, it seems that something more than swan isn't godly this time, but is human, the shoulder slipping out from its fallible costume. And it's this blurred boundary between the human, the godlike, and the bestial that fascinates Phillips, as if the differences between beast, god, and human depend on the subtleties of our recognition. As God's people, Phillips' poetry, the poems read as prayers, and they're often deeply erotic. David Baker has written that Phillips succeeds in bestowing a high dignity to privacy and intimacy. And the poems conjure this unsayable, give reverential voice to the most intimate thoughts and longings. Phillips' poems are not overtly political, but they do encourage the reader to reorient the relationship between margin and center as a hushed privacy is brought to the center of the page and to our attention. Phillips was born in Washington State in 1959. His father was in the Air Force, and Phillips' family moved 10 times in 10 years. This restlessness finds its way into the poems, which shed their images and propositions, are full of maybes, perhaps, or, as the poems revise themselves mid-sentence and enact the process of thinking and rethinking. Phillips went on to study Latin and Greek at Harvard as a scholarship student. He studied and he also worked cleaning dormitories. He wrote poetry as a college student, but then gave up writing poetry for a while. In interviews, Phillips has said that his return to poetry coincided with his discovery of his homosexuality, that he sorted things out in the private place of the poem. In an interview, Phillips has also said that he's led to write poetry, and I quote, by things that I don't quite understand about myself, or that I'm afraid to understand, or that I wouldn't dare try to understand in the presence of people who are in my life. His poems take tremendous risks to forge understandings on the verge of fear. His poems are true instruments of inquiry, and we can all learn from his findings. Please join me in welcoming Carl Phillips.
Hi, thank you. Thanks, Johnny, that was a splendid introduction. Frightening because I feel I need to live up to it. Thanks for having me here, Helena, for inviting me, and Karen for squiring me around and making sure I don't get lost in the metropolis of Ithaca, and the students I've met so far who are very kind, who are worried when I want to walk by myself back to the hotel at night. So I appreciate that you care. Okay, I'll read some poems. The Life You Save. After the pine fields, there's the marsh. You can see it from here. And after that, history ending, myth as it starts to stir. And after that, just the turning back again, nothing you won't know already, the pine field, the marsh, and the reeds too, the reeds that grow there? Yes, and the reeds that grow there, beautiful, invasive, they jostle in the smallest wind. Soon it will be as if nothing had ever happened. Is this the time when I'm supposed to make sure that the mic works and all that? I guess it does. This is called Distortion. Distortion. Oh, right, I brought this little clock up because my watch broke. My little hotel alarm clock. Okay, distortion. Having opened to their fullest, they open further. Now the peonies, near to breaking, splay groundward. Some even touch the ground. And though I do understand, yes, that they're not the not-so-lovely after all example of how excess, even in its smallest forms, seems to have its cost, I think it anyway. I even think they look, more than a little bit, like rough sex, once it's gone where, of course, it had to. Do you know what I mean? His smell on you after, like those parts of the gutted deer that the men bring home with them, fresh from the hunt. As if you were like that now, the parts, not the smell. I mean, as if you were his, all you'd ever wanted to be, and how you almost believe that. Do you see that too? According to Augustine, it's a distortion of the will that leads to passion, a slavish obedience to passion that leads to habit, until habit in turn becomes hunger, a need. What is it about logic, when delivered unflinchingly, that makes a thought like that sound true, whether true or not? Significant of nothing but a wind that, rising suddenly, falls as suddenly again back. The trees swing briefly in the same direction, as if I couldn't quite admit yet to a kind of grace in synchronicity, and had asked for proof, and the trees were one part of it, another the light at this late afternoon hour when it works both against and in the body's favor, like camouflage, which in the end is only distortion by a prettier name. I know all about that. You can call it heartlessness, an indifference to ruin, a willed inability to be surprised by it. You'd be mistaken. Don't go. Let me show you what it looks like when surrender and an instinct not to run side by side. Immaculate each leaf and every flower. And everywhere the smaller birds again noising, filling steadily all the cracks between spells of rain. As if song could still mean something useful. Or a kind of pleasure that, like forgiveness, came easily, and summer storm that forgiveness is, passed quickly through. And the undersong that has been your own voice saying no. No, I'm not afraid. What we cannot do, what we cannot undo, all the work we must do. As for ruin, yes, but faintly. The gray of doves in shadow. Can you tell I hate poetry patter? This is called Shimmer. He'd have drowned without me. The eyes stay shut. The mouth spills slightly open. The lips move, or the snow's movement makes them seem to. I can't tell. The gulls huddle as they will in a storm, the snow not so much settling on as hovering about them, the wind in sudden gusts lifting their feathers, then the feathers finding again those positions that make flight for a time look possible. When did souvenirs of what happened start becoming tokens of what could have been, becomes one of those questions that more and more I keep forgetting to stop asking. Now the snow seems a minor chord, now a form of mercy, making less hard the edges of what's hard. What's the point in asking? Why not rest my head upon the mirror that his chest is? This poem is called Mirror, Window, Mirror. It's in these three parts, but you know, they're not numbered. You just kind of make a sort of mysterious pause between. Okay. Mirror, window, mirror. Yes, any sky at night when the flickering of snow lightning gently punctuates it, whatever it is when it's not bewilderment or daring and not fear either, also the mottled bark of sycamores in autumn for where the skin was like that, yes. But more like arousal? Or more instead like the mind, just before the idea of arousal courses bluntly through it? That part about the body asking for it to be broken into. Is that the first or last part? Conquest. speaking to himself, I think, not me. You have wanted more than was yours to wish for, he said, as if even to wishing the laws of modesty and excess could be applied and should be. We slept. I dreamed. We'd sworn never to do harm, then sworn instead to keep trying hard not to. A kind of progress. In the dream, he was powerful, a hawk, or hawk-like, this time easily distinguishable from the gentler animals and that relentlessness with which, like beaten slaves, by now used to it, they rise and they fall. The reason I don't do patter is because I only say stupid things. So that's why. So that was my little bit of patter right there. So, I don't know. This is called Almost Tenderly. It had the heft of old armor, like a breastplate of bronze, like a shield on hinges. It swung apart like a door. Inside it, the sea was visible. The sea and, on the shore, a man, stripped, beaten. Very gently, tenderly almost, as if to the man, to calm him, but in fact to no one, the sea was singing. Here, in the deepening blue of our corruption, let love be at least one corruption we chose together. But the man said nothing. Why not call restlessness our crown and our dominion, sang the sea. But the man was a brokenness like any other, moving until it fails to move, the way over time suffering makes no difference. His wounds were fresh, still open. Where the light fell on them, they flashed, like the sea. Though I actually think suffering does make some difference, but not as much as we'd like to think. Surrounded as we are, unlit, unshadowed. Squalor of leaves, November, a lone hornet's nest, paper wasps, place where everything that happens is as who says it will, because. As in, why shouldn't we have come to this? Why not? This far, this close to that below zero where we almost forget ourselves, rise at last unastonished at the wreckery of it, what the wreckage some days can seem all along to have been mostly, making you wonder what fear is for, what prayer is, if not the first word, and not the last one either, if it changes nothing of what you are still, black stars, black scars, crossing a field that you've crossed before, holding on tight, though careful, for you must be careful, so easily torn is the veil diminishment comes down to as it lifts and falls. See it falling, now it lifts again. Why do we love at all? Because it's worth trying. That's why. It is, you know, and the more painful, actually, the better you learn. As I said to some MFA students and PhD students last night, it's important to have your heart routinely broken. It is. Fascination. Guttering in its stern urn. Huh, fascination. Guttering in its stone urn from a century by now too far away. The candle made of the room a cavernousness, the shape of the light getting cast upward onto the room's ceiling, became a kind of moon, some overlooked last round of desire, unclaimed, searching. There are places still that no moonlight ever quite conquers. A thickness of brush, the crossed limbs of cathedral pines defend the dark, inside which, beneath it, the trapped fox has stopped mutilating its own body to at last get free. Has stopped trying. Consigns the rust-colored full length of itself to the frosted ground. Which I now think, as I just occurred to me as I was reading it, maybe that's a little bit of a metaphor for what can happen, the vulnerability of love. You might end up just like caught in that trap, you know, that you are giving it up. But on the other hand, it might turn out better. You'll never know if you don't take that chance. This is called Storm. From the waist down, at least, nothing unfamiliar. Cypress trees, the catalpa, its seed pods hanging like shadow icicles, and the light around them, and the bodies that enter the light and leave it, your own among them. But as when the body seems most to want, impossibly, to step free of itself, oblivion of wish, of wishing, about sanctuary, how over time it makes the birds come closer. How that's different from trust, isn't it? What the fuck do you think you're looking at? He says softly. What a thing to say. The mind protecting itself by shutting down an intimacy that most likely won't be returned. Why expect it? As if that were the mind's chief purpose, to resist a fall, though falling's what the body does best, is quick to rise for, moving toward you with all the ceremony of many wings at once outspread, a holiday descending. The dark adjusts itself, settles its wings inside you. The shadows that strut the dark open and fold like hope, a paper fan, violence in its pitch and fall, like waves, above them the usual seabirds, their presumable indifference to chance, its blonde convergences. As when telling cruelty apart from chivalry can come to seem irrelevant, or not anymore the main point, he touches himself here and here, directive, turns his face away. It can look like ransom. Now it looks like privilege. Now recklessness. Now triumph. Gravel and blood. Humiliation. Lovely. Now strict refrain. He taketh my hand in his. Hey. The need for dreaming. As a scar commemorates what happened, so is memory itself but a scar. As in, given hunger, which is endless only until it isn't, he destroyed what he could. And then? So the lover enters the beloved, enters and withdraws. So a yellow-crested night heron wades into view, then out. Useless? It gets harder to say. Like signs of struggle in a field where nothing stirs, the past can seem everywhere. I think to be useless doesn't have to mean not somehow mattering. Years now, and still I can't stop collecting the strewn shells of spent ammunition where I come across them. Carefully, I hold each up toward what's left of the light. Oh, this is one of those one-sentence poems that I always recommend to my students for a cheap and safe activity on the weekends. See how long you can, you know, make a sentence go and all is grammatically correct. It's fun. You can have a party. It's called Black Swan on Water in a Little Rain. Seen this way, through that lens where need and wanting swim at random toward each other, away again, and now and then together, he moves less like a swan, black or otherwise, than like any man for whom sex is, or has at last become, an added sense by which to pass ungently but more entirely across a life where, in between the silences, he leaves what little he's got to show for himself behind him in braids of water, green to blue wake of please and don't hurt me and you can see I'm hurt already. It's a little swan poem thing. And I feel I'd be remiss if I didn't do something that mentioned the Iliad. I was speaking to a class today and saying it was my favorite book of all time, actually. But you don't have to have read it to understand things or something. Okay, late empire. I mean after the lashing. After the welts that the lash gave rise to have healed so beautifully, we forget where they were. Here, we say, pointing vaguely, as toward a bird that could as easily be a sparrowhawk, any other falcon, as if it made no real difference now, though it must somewhere, it should, as between grand events and those that are less grand, or as when the Greeks described fate as a thing of substance, weighable on a set of scales, pourable into steep urns, one for happiness, another for woe, and the urns tipped accordingly by Zeus, as from the vantage point that only a god can have, he saw fit, which is only a way of understanding fate, not a form of acceptance, not a road to get there. There's a kind of fragility that confounds appearances, where what little strength that the body has left to it, though almost none at all, seems inexhaustible. And there's a fragility that is most like what sex amounts to when stripped of justice and imagination. One more way of leaning up against and at the same time containing the fact of death, even as we ignore it or for a time lose track, wondering instead at the heave and shallow that the wind can be sometimes, as if the wind were a sea of water, the world presenting itself in the smallest of shards that very briefly surface, then they fall back away. Words like torture and worshipful, winnow and chaff, fairness continuing to have nothing to do with it. No one gets to decide. Just look at all the damage I might never have done. Alrighty. This is called Civilization, and I realize suddenly the titles of these poems become very lofty. Late Empire, Civilization. You'll see. I don't know, it must have been a phase I was going through. Civilization. There's an art to everything. How the rain means April and an ongoingness like that of song until at last it ends. A centuries old set of silver handbells that once an altar boy swung processing. You're the same wilderness you've always been, slashing through briars the bracken of your invasive self. So he said in a dream. But the rest of it, all the rest, was waking. More often than not, to the next extravagance, two blackamoor statues, each mirroring the other, each hoisting forever upward his burden of hand-painted, carved-by-hand peacock feathers. Don't you know it? Don't you know I love you? He said. He was shaking. He said, I love you. There's an art to everything. What I've done with this life, what I meant not to do, or would have meant, maybe, had I understood, though I have no regrets, not the broken but still flowering dogwood, not the honey locust either, not even the ghost walnut with its non-branches whose every shadow is memory, memory. As he said to me once, that's all garbage down the river now, turning, but as the utterly lost, because addicted, do. Resigned all over again. It only looked, it must only look like leaving. There's an art to everything, even turning away. How eventually even hunger can become a space to live in. How they made out of shamelessness something beautiful for as long as they could. Heaven and Earth. For days now, vertigo, conqueror birds, place where suffering and a gift for it for a moment meet, then go their separate ways. I keep meaning to stop, to wait for you. Places where, all but untrackably, fear, which is animal, and wild, and almost always worth trusting, becomes cowardice, fear given consciousness of a finite existence in the realm of time, what exists and doesn't. Last night, a stillness like that of moss, like permission when it's not been given, yet not withheld exactly. Across the dark, through it, the occasional handful of notes. Someone else out there singing, or myself singing, and the echoing after. I didn't know or want to. A map unfolding, getting folded back up again, seeming sometimes, even as I held it, to be on fire. It had seemed my life. What am I, that I should stand so apart from my own happiness? The stars did what they do mostly, looked unbudging, transfixed, like cattle asleep in a black pasture, all the restlessness torn out of them, away, done with. I turn beneath them. Someone told me recently in a reading not to do this, but I'm going to do it because I appreciate it at a reading. There are three poems left. She told me that was a stupid thing to say and it was insulting to the audience. And I thought, well, I've been an audience a lot, and I kind of like knowing where I am. So that's where you are. The Raft. Color of rust, russet, color of fall. I can lay my head on the wet sand that is nobody's chest now, not a chest at all, or I can lift it. Why not lift it? More fugitive than lost, more spent than stranded, if I've been no stranger to disillusionment, nor am I enslaved to it. The one who wanted me just to hold him gently, the one whose mouth was his only tenderness, the one with whom, about whom, who was a light as off of water that kept unsettling like thought itself, like the scrim of thinking when pierced suddenly by what nothing but instinct, pure gut, explains. Inside me, the old desires half negotiate, half meander their way back again, find those places they never stray too far from, or not for long. I had thought the truth would be a falcon, for how it rarely soars, as much as for that precision with which, on wings instead built for speed mainly, it descends then strikes. But it is not a falcon. The truth is a raft, a rough at each of its edges affair of many sturdinesses lashed together. Standard beauty, realized expectation. The lucky ones get to choose, and they choose when they want to. From this distance, it's hard to tell at first. The raft's moving closer, I think, though it's still far away. Dominion. Sometimes I take the leather hood off. I refuse to wear it, as if I were king, or a man who's free. Ravens, red-tailed hawks, the usual flocks of drifting, most of the time strangers, settle the way even things that drift have to, and I don't care. All over again, I know things that nobody knows or wants to. Things that, though prettier maybe, against the snow of memory, can still hurt all the same. Any blame falling where it falls, that random. That moment each day when the light traveling across what's always been mine to at any point take back or give elsewhere, becomes just the light again, turning back to dark, when the branches stir as they've stirred forever, more tenderly over some of us than others. Sing or don't sing. Help me take this leather hood off. I refuse to wear it. I'm the king. I'm free. And I'll end with this poem that is called Silver Chest, but it reminds me that of a reading where I was, someone said, I'll end with this poem that's in 12 parts, 6 of which are in French. And it was a dialogue between like Wittgenstein and Chopin. Oh, whoa, that was unfair. So, but I instead will end with this poem that it's short. It's called Silver Chest. Unafraid is what we were, I think, and then afraid, though it mostly seemed otherwise. I opened my eyes, I saw, I closed, I shut them. The usual morning glories twist up through banks of gone wild by now holly. Crickets for song, morphos for their glamour, which is quiet, blue and quiet. You, the dark that nothing, not even the light, displaces. You, who have been the single leaf that won't stop tossing among the others. For you. Thanks very much. Do I stay and I say things like, you want to ask stuff? Is that what I say? I'd answer things if you want to ask them. hate this part. But you don't have to. Yes? Yes? Yes, hi.
What significance does the title Speak Low have?
It's a good question. It comes from the Billie Holiday song, Speak Low. And in that song, she talks about how it seems almost like a superstition, like we have to speak low about our love because the days are fleeting and romance will end before we know it. And so, and it reminded me of this poem by the Roman poet Catullus, where the idea that you're supposed to, there's a suspicion about no one knowing that you're in love with somebody, because once they know, if they know how many times you've kissed somebody, for example, then they can cast a spell on you. So you're supposed to kiss the person so many times that they can't keep track. Maybe it's kind of a line to get somebody to kiss them, but the Speak Low song is somewhat like that, this idea that we have to be careful, because before we know it, if we start speaking too loudly of our love, we'll know it, other people will know it, and before you know it, it's all over. And our summer days will be gone. So that was the significance of it. And I happened to be listening to that song. I had never heard it until a few years ago. And I was just mesmerized and played it over and over. And I couldn't come up with a title for a poem that I had written, and then I thought, I think Speak Low is a title, that's why you keep listening to this song, and then later it became a title for the book. Kind of magical, is it not?
Hi. I wanted to ask you about difficulty. So critics will call your poems difficult, but I'm actually wondering if what you just said about Speak Low relates to difficulty, or how you see, is the reticence of your poems too, that they don't want to proclaim what they're about.
Well, they don't seem difficult to me, the things that people think are difficult aren't the things I think are difficult. I think the difficulty is wrestling with things that are, we don't like to think about. That part's difficult, but I think, they're in English. They're grammatically sound. I mean, I was a Latin teacher. I think the syntax is correct. And so I always think, well, is it that, I don't know, I guess maybe they're not overt, but I guess I like the idea of something that is a psychological, emotional narrative. And I like the idea that people might read my poems and feel the way I feel when I move away from an abstract painting. And maybe sometimes I think, okay, I don't get it. Other times I think, I don't know if I'm getting what I should, but I leave having felt something. And that seems valid. So I think when people think anything is difficult, it's because they have a set of ideas of how to interpret meaning. And if it doesn't fit their set, they think, oh, this must be hard and difficult. But maybe it just means, no, you need different equipment for this poem. I feel as if to read an Emily Dickinson poem requires a certain kind of set of skills for me. And then when I move to looking at something by Robert Frost, that's a whole different world. I mean, if you read nothing about Robert Frost and then you looked at Emily Dickinson, she would seem crazy and fragmented and really doesn't know much about punctuation and all of these things. And I think, no, you have to put him aside and say, now I'm with this sensibility. And so I think ideally, I would like to think readers would sort of commit, if they commit to a writer, they say, I'm going to have to learn, and the poems are going to teach me, if I'm willing to do that work, how to read these poems. So, it's a little roundabout. It sounded a little defensive, didn't it? We're on a roll. Sort of. See, all these students who were like making me drink last night, they were filled with questions last night. They had all these questions. And it's like, you know, drink up and what's your advice to young poets? That kind of thing. So, you know, take us to Felicia's and get in the back of the car. All that stuff. That was a whole different scene last night. And now they're all sitting back there acting like they're reticent.
Reception
would be delightful.
Yeah.